started. All right, so today, midterm review. Let me get a couple administrative things done, and then there's some questions that were already brought up in the chat, and then take some additional questions. So just as a reminder, let me get some more light in here. All right, so as a reminder, the ARAD is still available due Sunday. So there's a reading and a Canvas exercise rounding out our communication chapter. There's that lockdown browser compliance test. Make sure to take a look at that. Do this now so that you make sure that the lockdown browser works for you. And once you do that, that will open up the midterm review module where actually the midterm's located because it's a Canvas-based exam. And also a bunch of resources for studying for the midterm. So today we've got the midterm review. So we'll take some questions here. And then next week, just as a reminder, stage one, I think my plan is that I'm going to do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday will be stage one because it's a timed exam. So anytime Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, unless you have like a sales obligation where you've organized a particular time with them or so on and so forth. But generally speaking, anytime Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, you start the timed exam and then you have 90 minutes. And when the 90 minutes is up, then you lose, that's the end of your session. Or if you start it very late in the availability window and the availability window closes, that will also cut off your time. So, but you can start at any time, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. You don't have to come to class Tuesday. Someone will be here Tuesday in the classroom and it should be a quiet space. If you want to bring a laptop in and take it during the normal class period Tuesday, it doesn't look like there's anybody who comes in after this class. So if I think Sean or Anushka, I don't know if either of you guys are going to be here Tuesday, if you'll be okay staying for the full 90. So if you do come here and want to stay for the full 90, then that's fine. Otherwise, you don't have to. So you can take it at home. Whatever meets the lockdown browser requirements, that's fine with me. So that's the plan for stage one. As a reminder, you get one sheet of double-sided notes and you can get some blank scrap paper. I'm trying to be as inclusive as possible on this notes. You can draw on them. You can create them on your tablet and then print them out. I just don't want to see screenshots from screen captures from my slides or from the book or for some other resource. But if it's a graphical thing that you've created, if it's an image you've created, if it's a graph you've created, something you've drawn, now that's fine. If it's typed, that's fine. It just has to be clearly something that you put together and as opposed to something that you just took a capture of and then put on a page. So that's the key rule there. No scores or answers will be released after Wednesday, before stage two. So you go into stage two and all you know are the questions because stage two will have the same questions as stage one, the same content as stage one. But you're now open to collaborate with anyone else currently enrolled in the class. And you can, it's open book, open notes, open Canvas, anything I've provided you for this class, you can use, as well as your own notes. No lockdown, it's not timed. You can start it, on Thursday morning and come back to it Friday evening. Question? No. So Tuesday and Thursday, there will be someone here. So we provide the time and the space if you want to take it here. So you can take it during the lecture time. There will be no extra content. So next week is an exam week. But both of these things can be taken remotely. So if you've got travel plans and your other courses facilitate that, you don't have to be in Tempe to take either one of these stages. So, but if you are in Tempe, typically what happens, and it doesn't have to go this way, but typically nobody shows up to stage one. Last semester, I did have one person show up and then I said, oh, it's stage one. And they said, oh, I forgot there was an exam today. And then they left. So, but then it was empty and Anushka and I left after about 10 minutes. And that's, well, if nobody's here during any of those periods, after about 10 or 15 minutes, we'll just leave rather than hanging out here. And then stage two, typically what happens is about, say, 25% of the class will come, about 20 of them, 20% will sit over here and work together, audibly together, discussing the questions. And then the other 5% will sort of pepper throughout here, occasionally maybe going back and forth, but roughly kind of working individually, but listening in. And the other 75% of the class is elsewhere. So some of them are doing it individually. Some of them are using Discord or Slack to collaborate. Others, maybe they just found a different room to work together in. So you don't have to come to class, but if you do want to come to class, if that's a convenient time on your schedule to do the work on the exam, then that's fine to do. You get all of Thursday and all of Friday to submit your stage two. So availability disappears late Friday night. So that's the schedule. Any questions about the schedule, the layout? Yep. I'm going to do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I just decided this morning that since it's the timed one, I'm going to give you more flexibility. So hopefully that's okay. The other course I teach this semester, I made a similar decision and people seem to be happy with that. So Wednesday night, like Wednesday at midnight, so like Wednesday at 11:59 p.m., stage one disappears. So then Thursday at midnight, so Thursday at 12 a.m., so all of Thursday, all of Friday, stage two is open. While stage one and stage two are out, then it's going to be, at least for me, I'll be kind of off limits for content-based questions. So if you do have questions about animal behavior, then I have to be careful because if some of those, I won't know if you're just asking a question because you're interested, or you're asking a question because maybe you heard that that question was on the exam, and then I might accidentally give an answer away or something. So if you do have questions, today is a good time. Anytime between now and Monday is a good time to send them in, and I can respond to your questions. Like if I don't happen to get to your question before the exam comes out, but you sent it before the exam, I'll respond to it. But once we're in the exam week, then I have to not provide content questions just for fear that information about the exam would be out there. So the questions would be implicitly trying to get an answer from me as opposed to studying. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Send me questions up through Sunday night. That's fine. And then Monday through Friday, we view that as exam week. All right, any other questions about the schedule? Pretty clear on the format. Okay, and this is just echoing this. So this is your cheat sheet. One tip, I forgot to mention this, so that's why it's here, that's scrap paper. So you're not gonna have problems on this one. Like there's gonna be very little math that I could ask you to do, but I do have scrap paper there for you to organize your thoughts. And one of the things I encourage you to do is if there are questions on stage one that you want to investigate further so you can be more successful at them or be more confident about them in stage two, you can write those down on the scrap paper. I do assume that you're not going to then, like if somebody in the morning on Tuesday takes it and then writes down all the questions on the exam, giving it to someone in the afternoon would be academic misconduct, but I may not know you're going to do that. But one of the downsides for the whole class for that is like if there is a really hard question, like nobody gets it right, then there's a chance that I'll look at that question, sort of see like, why that might have been. I might everybody give, credit for that. But if people from the morning class report that there was this hard question, and in the afternoon class, they end up figuring out what the right answer is because they knew about that. And now I've got half the class did well and the other half didn't, then I'm not going to be able to make that adjustment. So, I mean, keep anything you record on those scrap paper to yourself. But then once stage two opens, then feel free to discuss, amongst yourselves. And then you can use that scrap paper so you know back to go back to stage two and be able to hit those questions. So I am going to number the questions the same on stage one and stage two. So you can just write down on stage one that, question 16, that's one that I want to make sure that I go back and maybe, look into more. So then when stage two opens, you might, open it up on Thursday, see what question 16 is, do a little studying on it, and then come back on Friday and give your answer. That's fine. Yep. Thursday through Friday. Yep. Yeah, I don't think I need 3 full days, and I just kind of like to knock it out on the work week. I mean, I guess I could probably make it available a little bit longer, but Usually the 2 days, I don't get complaints about that. Okay. Other things here, this is just, I said this, you can collaborate with other students currently enrolled. That's fine if you do that via Slack or Discord or other tools, but just make sure the only people in those channels are people that are enrolled. Okay. So yeah, that I'm not gonna, I just decided I was gonna poll here about preferences, but I think I'm just gonna make it easy and say Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, stage one, Thursday, Friday, stage two. Okay, so any general questions about the format before I get to some questions that were already left? Yep. So there's an example, the fall's midterm is online in that module. I recommend taking a look at that to see what the format is. Everything's auto-graded. So there'll be nothing that requires manual grading. That means that things are going to look a little bit like the Canvas exercises that you've seen every week. So I have some, like Canvas gives me a bunch of different auto-graded options. Like I have drop downs that relate to each other in paragraph form or whatever, but I'm not going to ask for any essay questions. So anything like that. Yeah. After stage two, but not stage one. So yeah, after stage two closes, I'm going to take a look at how everybody did, see if there's any adjustments that need to be made. And then as soon as possible, I'll release stage two, the solution set and your scores. In between stage one and stage two, if I have time, sometimes I'll do things like I might release aggregate statistics. Like I might say, I can't tell you what your score was, but I can tell you that the apparently hardest or most difficult questions were these five questions. Less than 40% of the class got these questions right, or something like that. And then sometimes that's helpful to because you might have said, well, but, that's one of the questions I thought I got right, but let me maybe go back and even though I didn't write that down, is one to look into because the rest of the class seems to have had a difficulty with that one. Maybe I had a misconception, so I'll go back and look at that. So if I have time, I'll try to do that between stage one and stage two to give some aggregate stats, but I won't give you your individual scores. Okay. Any other? Yeah. Yeah. Some will be multiple choice. Some might be multiple answers. So there might be like select all, or some will be drop downs. There won't really be a numeric option, but if I'm, if I come up to being clever, like if I could say like, how many bits are in, four yes no questions, and then I might have a numeric answer where I'm looking for two. Something like that, but there won't be a lot of like calculation-y things. A lot of things are like Canvas exercise. There might be, I leave the option open to do fill in the blank. I have to be careful about fill in the blanks because Canvas is, it's not empowered with a large language model behind it. So somebody adds a the, even like, if I say the blank is whatever, then, the half the class will end up also putting the in the blank. And I'll even say like the blank, and I'll say one word only, and I'll be bold and caps, and then still people will put multiple words, and then they have to go back. And so I hesitate, but if there's, I leave the option open. If there's something that's really compelling, but otherwise I'll probably have like a word bank. So like I'd rather probably give you 30 words, and you find the word in that 30 words rather than have you fill it in. Yep. What do you mean by the percentages? I think that I think I've got that up here somewhere. Oh, I guess I didn't need it in this slide. And 80% stage one, 20% stage two. So if you got 100% on stage one and you just decided not to do stage two at all, you'll get an 80% on the midterm. Likewise, if you decided not to do stage one at all and just waited for the collaborative, you only get a 20% on the midterm. So it's 80% times whatever this score is, plus 20% times whatever this score is. I can say it that way. The other way is like in the Canvas grade book, you're going to get grades for both of these. But whereas in the rubric, it says that this exam's worth, I don't know, so much percent to your grade. I just scaled those. And so as far as Canvas is considered, it's that percentage times 80 for this column and that percentage times 20 for this column. Okay. All right. Any other general questions? There were some specific questions that were left in the anonymous chat here, which I'll pull over. Whoa. I know this is dangerous. You know, anybody could submit something, and but maybe I should, on that note, maybe I should grab this and bring it down here just in case. Okay, so three questions. These are the first time I'm reading these. Can you go over about how mental time travel confounds proximate and ultimate questions? Okay, that's a so I wasn't saying that mental time travel necessarily does, but a lot of the assays of mental time travel, you have to be careful. Like, so there's two, we test behavioral ecologists, we test hypotheses. And you can have a cognitive hypothesis for a behavior, like a behavior that mental time travel was involved. So there's active thinking that went involved in planning that behavior, that involved considering an episode in the past and that potential episode happening again in the future and preparing for that episode in the future based on the episode in the past. That's kind of like mental time travel. And so that is one hypothesis to explain why an octopus might carry a coconut around with it to protect itself in the future. That's one hypothesis to explain why some stingless bees that are always fed at noon come back at 11:45 the next every other day before food is even coming out. They're doing a mental time travel. It's a cognitive explanation. But there could be more parsimonious explanations that that may not need, like, you get the exact same predicted behavior without assuming that you've got a thinking process going on. So in the case of the octopus, then it may just be that the octopus has an affinity for things that are coconut colored or things that are the shape of shells. Like, it might be that, you know, like, an octopus is not, it was not evolved with an in an area where coconuts were frequently cut in half. Octopuses are very old lineage, and this carrying coconuts around with them, the coconut octopus, probably is a behavior that they had that was probably before you had humans coming in and cutting open coconuts and having these perfectly cut coconut shells float to the bottom of the seafloor. But there's probably other shells that have that shape that they might pick up in an almost a hermit crab-like way. So hermit crabs are false crabs. They've got sort of these special set of legs that are made just to hold their shells up together. And you can imagine that, you know, an octopus might also be attracted to a shell the same way a hermit crab is. And if it's a big enough shell, a round enough shell, then they'll carry that around with them. And that's why they might carry a coconut around with them. And so, but octopus that have carried that around with them happen to survive more because they're in an environment where it's nice, it's good to have shelter. So they may not need mental time travel. It's almost like the fitness benefits of carrying a shell are enough to explain why you have so many octopus that carry coconuts or shells around with them. So it's more a caution that if you have something that could be explained cognitively with, and this often happens with mental time travel, you have to ask yourself, is there a non-cognitive hypothesis, a non-cognitive explanation that might predict the same outcome? And if there is, can I design a new experiment where those two explanations would go in different directions so that I can more, you know, more have a more compelling case that it's cognition or not? So this isn't always the case that mental time travel confounds proximate and ultimate, but it's more a caution that cognitive explanations, because they're as if the animal is thinking about function. Well, if we're putting the function inside the animal, we're now getting very close to mixing function and mechanism. And that's what we're saying here. We have to be careful with any cognitive explanation, is that they all have a tendency of doing that. Like, you have to ask yourself, is I, you know, the cognitive explanation puts function in the animal, in the animal's thought process. Is there a way I could separate that and see it? And even if it is inside there, like, people will say, you know, that, oh, well, this, this autonomous vehicle, this Waymo, will never get into this accident because it has been programmed to avoid those cases. And you know, and so in that case, you can say, okay, so you're telling me it's never going to happen because you've built a mechanism that avoids that thing happening. But how do you know that your mechanism works all the time? Maybe the sun is going to be, you know, super bright that day and its camera-based sensors aren't going to work. You know, maybe it's going to be raining and its LIDAR that's spinning around, you know, those laser sensors that spin around, whenever they hit raindrops, it's like there's a wall there. And so that's part of the reason why they don't often drive around in the rain. It's like their LIDAR becomes almost useless. So you could say, yeah, it might be thinking about its outcome, but that mechanism doesn't always provide the function. Even though that mechanism has been designed to provide the function, it has to be combined with the right environment to actually give you that function. So even if the hypothesized mechanism involves thinking about function, it may not actually provide that function. So those are just things that we have to worry about. You know, do we need function to be actively thought about inside the animal? Is there a way to pull it out? And even if it's thinking about inside the animal, does it necessarily provide that function? So that's what I'm saying there. So I don't know who asked that question, but are there follow-ups to that? Does that ex this is so, you know, every time I have these questions in the PowerPoint slides, like, so I go to a question slide, it has a little link. And then if you follow that link on a question slide, you can submit these questions. And so these can accumulate. Every lecture, I have one of those question slides, and it has a QR code and a link that goes to this site where you can submit these anonymously. Sean. Yeah, the course information module, there's a link in there. And it's just links.asu.edu/bio331questions. It'll take you to this poll everywhere where you can submit these. Other questions about this first point? Hopefully that helped. Then there's a you know, was the Bumblebee example in lecture C3 about mental time travel? How does it relate to Morgan's canon? So this, the Bumblebee example, those were when they were stringing, they were pulling those strings. I would say that wasn't about mental time. That was about ends and means reasoning. So the Bumblebee example, that was where he trained them to pull strings on little discs, to pull the discs out from underneath a table so they could drink from the center of the disc. And then after training them on straight ropes that are to those, then he tested them on a bunch of tables where the ropes weren't. They didn't match the training situation perfectly. They were a different color. They were maybe in little loops and stuff like that. And so there was about if did they learn just a pattern that, okay, when I see something that's shaped like a lollipop, a straight rope and a disc, that's what I pull on to eventually get sugar? Or is it about ends and means? Like, oh, I can see that I'm pulling on this rope, and that is my means to get to the end, that as I'm pulling on the rope, that is a way that I'm solving this problem. And I can generalize to other ropes that are shaped different ways. And they sort of showed that the bumblebees did not show ends and means. Pretty much they only, if they were trained on the straight rope with the disc, pretty much they only would tug on a straight rope. So you could use just visual pattern matching. So you didn't need a cognitive process to explain the bumblebee results. And so we might say from there, that is not evidence for bumblebee cognition in that context. But it's not mental time travel. Mental time travel is something happened to me at one point in my episodic memory, and it was re relative to a time of day or some time element. And so in the future, when those time contexts are true again, then I prepare for that. So I anticipate that that's going to happen. And so the idea of anticipating that something's going to happen at a particular time based on what's happened at a previous time, that's mental time travel. Any questions about that? Follow-ups. And the other one here, could you go over motivation drive theory and how it relates to mind and body? So the in that, so these are all cognitive questions. So this here, some of the early theories in animal behavior. Well, so really about motivation. People are just interested in what motivates animals. And so the thought was that animal behaviors don't appear to only be responses to triggers, releasers from the environment. So much about animal behavior is about releasers and fixed action patterns. So there's this famous example where there's a goose, and they notice that this particular species of goose, when there's an egg outside her nest, if you put the egg in front of her, she'll roll the egg all the way back to the nest. And if you grab the egg while she's rolling it, then she will continue to roll an invisible egg all the way back to the nest. That's a fixed action pattern. That's one of the first demonstrations that it's fixed. It was released by the egg. And once it was released, it just has to unroll, literally, I guess, or virtually. And then that's the only way to end it there. So it was a direct response to the environment. This behavior got turned on and it wouldn't turn off until it was done. So that there's that view of animal behavior, but people look at that and that feels like it's missing things. Like, what if there are other behaviors that seem to be spontaneous? What motivates an animal to do something in a context where if they were in that exact same environmental context the previous day, they didn't do that? What is that motivation? And so people thought, well, there must be some internal drive. And so drive theory was the one of the first abilities to put something like a mind inside the body of an animal. So when we say body, we're talking about the physical wetware, the goose and the egg, the goose and the environment around the goose, the physiology of the animal. That's the body. And so, but when we talk about the mind, we're saying that maybe there's something that it's probably implemented in wetware somewhere. Well, we don't understand how it emerges from these complex neural interconnections inside these animals. So we're going to approximate it as a mind, a separate mind that is sort of separate from the body, which itself is its own input. So even though it's like we can't observe the mind of the animal, but the animal responds to the mind as if it was the egg right in front of the goose. That's the idea of mind and body, is that it is, and it's an internal stimuli that is just as powerful as external stimuli. And then, much of psychology is built around the dynamics of that internal stimuli. What are you feeling right now? How do your feelings change over time? And some of the early work in that in animals was this drive theory, is to say we need a model for these dynamics. And people said, well, maybe the animal's really tired one day, but really amped up the previous day. So they had these hydraulic models where, they kind of had fuel in the tank. The elephant has a lot of reproductive fuel in the tank versus an elephant that is not during mating season and doesn't. And so when it has a lot of reproductive fuel in the tank, it puts a lot of pressure on the elephant. And if the elephant has the ability to mate, it will. But if it doesn't have the ability to mate, that pressure has to go somewhere. And then it comes out in an aggressive behavior toward a fence or toward another elephant or toward a human. And so that was the idea. It's like there's this internal stimulus that is like a tank of high pressure fluid that's pushing down on the animal and causing it to respond. That's the idea here behind drive theory. So where the drive was sort of an early example of what we view as the mind of the animal. And now comparative psychologists, think about animals as having as complex minds as we think we do. And so then you think about, animal emotions and, how is the animal feeling right now? The experience of the animal. Was the animal recently afraid? Was the animal recently to have a good response? Like all of those things. So you have a complex set of stimuli inside the animal that are separate from the body that we're calling the mind. Does that clear any of that up in your mind? Likewise, right there in your mind. So that idea that hopefully you come into a class like this and you leave the class like this and you leave empowered with new tools and facts and trivia and so on. But I cannot point to what in your body changed coming into this class versus coming out of it. Maybe you got a suntan, you know, there are all these things that just are confounded with time, but I don't know where all of this stuff that I'm telling you or that we talk about goes. And so we say it goes into your mind, but we don't know where. We think the mind is primarily in the brain, but where is the animal behavior part of your brain? That's what a cognitive neuroscientist would like to know. And that's what people are working on, but we're nowhere near understanding all of that. So that's what we mean by mind and body. We can make progress with the mind, even though we don't know where it is in the body. All right. Any other questions related to these? Any other questions? Let me make sure that nothing else has popped up here. Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, I see. Yeah, cross-fostering. We just read a paper with the grad students about cross-fostering of what were you talking about? Who was cross? There were honeybees, right? And they were cross-fostering the honeybees because we were interested in microbiome and CHC. So just read a paper with the grad students about people, the CHCs that we talked about, the cuticular hydrocarbons that are outside of insects. Well, they give identity. So one honeybee colony smells different than another honeybee colony based on these cuticular hydrocarbons. So people don't know the mechanism that creates those differences. And there was a suggestion that the microbiome inside the gut of the honeybee was strongly predictive to the cuticular hydrocarbons there. So that was an internal environment there. So they did a cross-fostering experiment where they raised honeybees from one colony with a different colony of honeybees and then looked at the microbiome inside the gut of those honeybees, as well as the hydrocarbons on the outside of those honeybees, and saw to what extent those two things matched their home colony or their new colony. And that was a way to separate the gene by environment interactions. And that's generally, you know, that's what we talk about for cross-fostering. That is how that works, is that it's a tool for saying we see a phenotypic difference from one group to another group. They live in different environments. So we don't know if the difference we see is genetic, in which case it would be called an ecotype. So if it's been selected, if these ones over here, if the environment has put selective pressure on them to change, that means that it's almost like you had a third set. You had a general set that split off, and all of these had a wide mix of phenotypes. And the group that went over here brought that mix. And in the ecotype case, the ones that had the phenotypes that don't fit the environment died out. And the ones that had the phenotype that fit the environment expanded and took over. And then they have a heritable difference, a genetic difference in this environment. And over here, the opposite thing happened, where you had a mix of phenotypes, you bring them to this environment, and this environment selects for a different set of those phenotypes to end up spreading. Those are ecotypes. Those are genetically determined differences. If you now go and bring those back together into a common garden, then we would expect to see the differences persist because they're genetic. They're not environmentally determined. But it could be that actually nothing happened to the organism except for the inputs to the organism changed, the environment changed. So maybe the phenotype is it's the same genes, but they're eating different stuff. And so if you eat a lot of this particular, so here, you know, they were eating, you know, all, you know, fruits and vegetables. And then now they went over here and now they're eating, you know, a bunch of meat. And then over here, they're eating a bunch of, I don't know, garlic or something like that. And so these are very different food sources. And that might lead them to express different phenotypes. Maybe these ones all have orange fur, these ones all have green fur, and these ones have purple fur or something like that. So we don't know if it's the genes or the environment. So cross-fostering would say, if let's take a new, you know, you know, they a very early in development, like an egg, you know, a brood item from a population here, and let's raise it with a population here. and vice versa. And if it's the genes, then they'll act like wherever they came from. If it's the environment, they'll act like wherever they developed. That's cross-fostering. And that helps us figure out, is it a gene or an environment, or to what extent is it? Questions about that? And there are, like I said, common gardening is another way to get a similar thing. Okay. All right, we are all caught up. Of course, we can revisit these. I'm just gonna tab back to the PowerPoint. And just at this point, I've gotten to by the way, if you didn't notice that, all these question slides, this QR code and this link allow you to submit those questions. And so I try to have these guys watch those during class, but then if we miss one, then after class, when I'll go back and review those, and then I can post solutions on Canvas if questions do come up that you guys didn't want to raise your hand for and just wanted to post anonymously. All right, so with that, happy to take more questions. The slides here is I basically went through every lecture and I grabbed three or four slides, which I thought for that lecture captured what I thought were the key points of that lecture, and I assembled them here. I can go through these to see if they generate any questions, but if you already have questions, you can just raise them up, or I could go through these, and if you just think of something unrelated, then you don't have to wait for us to get to that. You can then immediately ask that question. So, but that's all I've got prepped for today is this and what we've already done. So any questions that somebody really want? Yeah. Yep. I would say that mostly no. They're like the bumblebee thing. I'm not going to ask you to remember things about the large chick bumblebee thing, but I might set up the thing. Like I might in a question say, imagine an experiment with bumblebees that's set up this way, and then I might ask you questions about it. There are certain fundamentals like the handicap principle, Timbergen, just because it's so foundational to animal behavior, good to know who that is. Timbergen's four, good to know. But specific experiments, especially if I just use them as examples, like something about a blue-footed booby or whatever, like those specific natural history examples. This isn't a natural history class, and so I do want you to hopefully carry some of those examples away with you. But if you need one of those for the question, I'll probably set the question up and give you the background. And again, I do that, I think, in some of the sample midterm questions. Yep. Yeah, you're only, yes, I will. I'm not gonna, there might be like one question about the difference between broad sense and narrow sense heritability. Largely, if I talk about heritability on the exam, it's gonna be narrow sense. But the idea has to do with that you can have multiple genes that each have multiple alleles. And if So I could ask, like, imagine I'm a doctor or something like that, and I can say, and I look at your genetic profile, and I could ask, what allele do you have at this location? Or what allele of this gene do you have? And then I can ask, what allele for this other gene do you have? Now, I know there's certain risk factors for this gene if you have certain alleles. And I know there's certain risk factors for this gene if you have certain alleles. Now, the question is, if you have both, what's your risk profile? Now, if it's additive, which means like, because you've got this allele, your chance of heart disease went up by a certain amount. And then if you've got this other one, you're like, oh, well, because you have this allele, your chance of heart disease went up by this amount. Then the additive, which is going to be related to narrow sense, is that, well, then your total risk is just the risk for here plus the additional risk of this one. And that's it. That's an additive genetic variance. But it's possible that these two alleles or these two genes interact. And so there might be that it might be that if you just have this allele, your risk goes up by a certain amount. If you just have this one, your risk goes up by a certain amount. But if you have these two, your risk goes up by way more than the sum. And that interaction effect is a bit of genetic variance, which is captured in broad sense heritability. So it's like the idea that if you were to say how heritable, how much genetic, how much phenotypic variation is explained by genetic variation in the population. That's what heritability is all about. The narrow sense thinks of things in an additive way. They say that, well, if I look out there, there's a lot of people out there that have this particular allele on this gene, and there's a lot of people that have this allele on this particular gene. And if I look at the number of people that have these two alleles, then that explains a lot of the phenotypic variation in this disease that's out there in the population. But what that's missing is that there's this overlap of people that have both, and that some of that is additive, but there's some part of that phenotypic variation that if you just have an additive model that just says, like, well, if you have this gene and this gene, you add those two effects together, you're going to miss some of that. Like there'll be extra variation that isn't explained. And so in order for me statistically to handle that, I have to create, and this is getting me outside the scope of this class, I have to create a statistical model that has how many people have this gene, how many people have this gene or this allele, how many people have both? And in my statistical model, it's like a linear regression where I have these independent variables. So before it's like I had this independent variable and I had this independent variable. Now I have to think about how many people have both. And once I put that in, then I have the ability to finally explain all the variation I'm seeing in the phenotype. But if I don't have this interaction, then I have this like extra noise that isn't explained by just these things alone. So if you have that fine-grained statistical model that has not only knowing how many people have this, how many people have this, but how many people have both, then you can ask what is the broad sense heritability of this trait. But if you don't have that, and you rarely are going to have that for every single gene that people have in the population, because you don't know what genes are contributing to those traits. You just know that there's gene variation out there. Then the best you can do is this narrow sense heritability. And breeding experiments is usually how you get at that. In the breeding experiments, you just look at like, what's the phenotype of mom and dad? What's the phenotype of offspring? And then that only gives you additive. So it only gives you the narrow sense. It's a little weird. Does that help? Okay. Yeah. If you really like the stuff, take a good, strong biometry class, followed up by like a pop gen class. And that's where you learn all this stuff. Or, I mean, in evolution, they talk about this a little bit too, the heritability stuff, the breeding coefficients and things like that. So that's really when you get into things like breeding or whatever, then you start really getting into this like sophisticated heritability stuff. But you really need the stats in order to understand broad sense heritability in a proper way. Other general questions? Like I said, I can just step on through here. So we had four units that we talked about this before this midterm. At the end of so at the beginning of every unit in Canvas, at the top of the module, I have a study guide that has something that looks like this. And so it says, like, by the end of this unit, students will be able to. If you want to know like what things to study, go to this thing, which is the top of every module in Canvas, and ask and go down each bullet and say, do I know how to do that? Do I know how to do that? And so on. When I design the questions, I go through this study guide and I say, do I have a question for that? Do I have a question for that? And so, I mean, I may not cover all of them, but that's how I design my questions. So I keep making passes through these lists in those four units. And I say, do I have a question that asks, that answers each one of those? That's how I build the question. So when you study, it's a great way to study is to say, how well do I feel like I've covered these bullets? Underneath that, I've got these important terms. So, after you feel like you've covered these, then sort of make sure that if you know these in theory, you know these. But that's a good spot check. And then, this is less important for the midterm. This is like how we talk about the success of the course overall, the stuff down here. But that's why this up here, that's kind of the key point there. And then at the beginning of every lecture, or at the beginning of every lecture section of this slide set, I've got the terms that I have at the end of every lecture. So, if you haven't noticed that, we do have this term list at the end of every lecture. These are the things that we've covered. So this is what we covered in lecture A1. So, and it has a quick definition for each one of those terms. So another great way to study is to review these things. So the big thing in this, that early unit, Tenbruggen's Four. It's a really fundamental part of animal behavior and this idea of proximate versus ultimate, this idea of proximate being the thing that we observe at small timescales, how do things work, all the way moving up through ultimate is what provides the function that keeps them in the population. So, if there are questions about this general framework, but I've been harping on about this, but super important. You take any behavioral ecology class, you're going to get this at any stage, grad level, undergrad level. So definitely know that stuff. So why and how? Proximate and ultimate. Know that proximate is how, ultimate is why. Okay. This kind of cone here, this is how we get diversity of mechanism. Again, I'm just sort of emphasizing ultimate as why, proximate is how. So there's a bunch of different ways you can achieve function, but not everybody can implement them the same way. So you have taxonomic constraints, phylogenetic constraints, evolutionary constraints, you have developmental constraints, and then that ends up with only we have certain mechanisms because we're humans, and humans that have certain developmental constraints, birds achieve the same things we achieve. They have the same functions, but they do it in very different ways because they have different constraints. So there's proximate, how it works for me and how it works for a bird, and ultimate, which involves the evolutionary question of, is it the same between me and a bird? And if not, at what point did it get different? And then also then the more kind of ultimate question of what function does it provide to both of us? Okay. Questions on that? Then general scientific process stuff. Know the difference between hypothesis, prediction, and causal question. A hypothesis answers a causal question. Causal question starts with how or why. Causal questions are organized by Tenbruggen's Four. And any causal question will be answered with a statement, which is the hypothesis. How do we get confidence in one hypothesis over another? We run experiments. Those experiments, it's the blue thing up here, end up causing us to ask predictions about the outcomes of those experiments. A prediction is an if-then statement. A hypothesis is not an if-then statement. So you say, under this hypothesis, under the hypothesis that dogs like blue or something like that, then I would make a prediction that if I give a dog a choice between blue and red, then under the prediction that dogs like blue, they'll go to the blue. That's kind of a trivial example, but that's the idea there. So, any questions about hypotheses, causal questions, and predictions? Okay. Ideally, we have multiple hypotheses for every question, but we have one experiment. So, for every hypothesis, we get a different prediction, but the experiment produces one set of results. And that's where the magic happens, because if we look through the predictions and compare the results, some of the predictions match the results and other predictions don't. And that helps us exclude some hypotheses. So that's the scientific process. All right. So looking forward, behavioral genetics and, or sorry, physiology. Umwelt was kind of a big thing that we talked about. Oops. Different pointer today. Umwelt is kind of the big thing I want you to take out of this, and then the evolutionary forces. So just stepping through that, behaviorism and ethology, Umwelt, again, that's sort of the big thing. It's another big thing. Tenbruggen's Four and Umwelt, the behavioral ecologists like favorite things, or like five favorite things, Tenbruggen's Four and Umwelt. in the or for a behavioral ecologist. And then in general, how these things combine, different mechanisms lead to different solutions. That's largely what I was just talking about. And then we talked about these evolutionary mechanisms. So again, I'm just sampling from these slides. So note that these reduce diversity, these increase diversity. This is slow mutation. This migration is relatively fast. The natural selection is non-random. Genetic drift is random. Genetic drift is really only a thing in small populations because big populations, you need a really big bad event in order to really affect a big population. So big populations, you see more selection. Small populations, you see more drift. Any questions? All right. So we went into behavioral genetics. So we already talked about cross-fostering, Gesundheit. Big things here, G by E is going to be a really big thing. So how do you get from genotype to phenotype? You can't exclude the environment. So that's G by E. That's the big thing to remember. And a big part of what we do in behavioral genetics is figure out how much is G and how much is E. We've talked a lot about that today already. So, there's G by G by E, and there's G by E by E, the two epis. So epistasis, you've got genes that can mask other genes. Epistasis comes from the word for standing on top of. So the idea is you've got one gene stomps out another gene, G by G. And so, when you've got like, if you need, you can only explain how one gene gets to phenotype if you know if another gene is present. That's epistasis. But then you also have epigenetics, where it's G by E by E, where you're like, there's a slow environment and a fast environment. So like your inner environment is something that might have been, it affected you in the past, but it stuck with you and it changes you. It changes the organism. So in order to know how that organism responds to more rapid changes in the environment, you need to know not only its genes, but its history. That's the idea behind epigenetics. And there are mechanisms of epigenetics, molecular mechanisms, which bolt on to the genes, which change how they're expressed over historical time. And that's the idea of epigenetics. And there's a lot of behavioral epigenetics now. We talked already about heritability, so I won't talk too much more about it here unless there are questions. And then the kind of modern synthesis, bringing all of these things together. Phylogeny, knowing that we would like to trace back where behaviors came from. We can use molecular methods to generate phylogenies and then use those molecular methods to correlate with what behaviors we see today to give us predictions of where those behaviors split off in the past and what are the kind of the new adaptations and what are sort of the older adaptations. So it's the idea there. So that's what we talked about there. Quantitative traits. This is a big thing because behaviors are largely quantitative traits. So understanding that quantitative traits come from variance across genes and the environment and interaction effects between genes. That's how we get behaviors which are not on-off switches. That we get, you can be a little aggressive or more aggressive or let, you know, or are really aggressive, so that's it's a quantitative trait. Ecotypes we already talked about, and these are some important examples of weird things that selection can do that are counterintuitive. Like they almost seem like things that should be selected out, but actually, if you think deeply about it, selection actually keeps them in. And so we've got those kind of examples there. So any questions then about these behavioral genetics back end here? Again, mostly, yeah. Agreed upon? What do you mean? Like how much support is there for epigenetics in the Well, I would say that there's always an epigenetic, whenever you're talking about how do you get from genes to phenotype, there are epigenetic hypotheses about the mechanisms, and then you have to test for them. And so and there are and I would say epigenetics doesn't mean it's vertically transmitted. So there could be epigenetic effects in me that if I were to have offspring, which I won't, but if I do, then those offspring are not going to have those modifications. So there are epigenetic changes to my soma, to my body cells, and then there's epigenetic changes to the germline. And there, I would say that there's very little evidence. There are very specific and rare examples where you see things that are non-genetic heritable factors. But where there are non-genetic heritable factors, there's a lot of research interest in trying to understand what's going on there. But most heritable factors that we know of seem to be well explained by genetics. Where epigenetics is really gaining strength is actually not in the heritability side, not in the how do you pass down adaptations, but more about how to explain how this messy machine works. And so, because in a lot of times, like, you know, you've got all of these genes which could be expressed, but they aren't being expressed the way you might expect them to based on environmental conditions. And that is being modulated by epigenetics. It's a way to say, oh, you know, we've already grown a leg. We can stop growing legs right now. So even though I have the grow a leg program, once I've grown that leg, then I can have epigenetic still stops and say, okay, we're done with the leg program. Let's move on. So they put pins in things so that you can have progress in the genetic program. Other questions about genetics, epigenetics, and so on? I will say, you know, as an adjunct, so an interesting thing is that fruit flies have been an animal that is an important model system for understanding genetics. You know, use them in high school and do breeding experiments and all that. But fruit flies don't have a methylation toolkit in their genetic repertoire. So there are epigenetics that happen inside fruit flies, but they are not anywhere close to as sophisticated as the ability of our genomes to do methylation, but social insects do. So now people are proposing alternative laboratory models to study epigenetics, in part because fruit flies were really the genetic animal of the past, but they are not the epigenetic animal of the future. So in order for us to get as much of a handle on behavioral epigenetics and epigenetics in general, we may have to divorce ourselves or move on from the hegemony or tyranny of the fruit fly. Okay. So that brings us to molecular genetics. Just know that you know, knowing all the details here is not that important for the midterm, but do know that it is possible for us to knock out specific genes, and that's a great way. If you have a candidate gene, like we think this gene is responsible for smarts, you know, this is the IQ gene. There won't be, you know, IQ is, it comes from lots of different genes, and those are genes that do lots of different things. They're pleiotropic genes, genes that are involved in multiple traits. But if you had a hypothesis that this is the IQ gene, the gene for smarts, then in reality, in, you know, in theory, you could go to an animal that expresses smarts, expresses intelligence, and you could, if you had the toolkit for it, you could knock out that gene using CRISPR or using RNA and then see what happens to that phenotype, see if it goes away. So theoretically, you can knock out genes and using these molecular engineering techniques, but it hasn't really paid off that well for a lot of general behavior studies. So that's why quantitative genetics is more the case. And that kind of gets back to this graph here. And so we talked about, you know, the QTL and all that that happened in a future lecture. So I have the highlights there. But this is, you know, just about, you know, reminding us again about epigenetics, the epigenotype, the molecular mechanisms underlying epigenetics. But, you know, just keep in mind that a lot of behaviors there, we do think that there's epigenetic regulation of behavior. So behavioral epigenetics is becoming a more important field. So we already talked about cross-fostering as one way to separate out G by E. You know, this example I've updated to make clearer. You know, another cross-fostering example. So I'll just head through there. Twin studies, this idea that, I hesitate to bring it up, but, you know, in the news recently, there were news about, you know, whether Tylenol, whatever, And there was a an important twin study that was brought up in discussing whether that conclusion that was made was right or wrong or whatever. And so, studying or something related to twin studies. And so this, twin studies can be, valuable if you have, especially in human cases where you can assess monozygotic and dizygotic. In animal studies, you often have to genotype in order to figure out these things. So, important tool for understanding G by E. And then common gardening. This is like super common gardening, I guess. That so bringing animals into the lab, seeing how much of their history comes with them. So bringing juveniles, bringing animals and then raising them in the lab and then seeing if they all become the same, even though they came from different, or if they maintain their differences. Common gardening is a very important tool for understanding that. Any questions so far? Only have a few minutes left. So if I were to go through these slides, I'll probably jump ahead here. Just to make sure we cover a little more, but Hardy-Weinberg, are we at equilibrium? I'm not going to ask you to calculate any Hardy-Weinberg, but know that Hardy-Weinberg can be used to assess whether we're at equilibrium or not. Quantitative trait loci and GWAS, GNOM1 associated studies. Knowing how to do QTL mapping is probably not as important, but knowing the what's the fundamental differences between QTL and GWAS. And what are they both trying to do, and how do they differ, and how they do it? That's important. And this is just getting through those same things there. So let's see what else we've got after this. Reminders about heritability, reminders about broad sense and narrow sense, how you can measure heritability, and so on. Hardy-Weinberg on our QTL and GWAS. So just some tips or hints about QTL and GWAS. So I think I've got our summary of QTL and GWAS right there. So any questions about the behavioral genetics stuff? So then after that, we went into communication or learning and cognition and communication. So we're starting getting back into more fundamental animal behavior. So again, I'll probably just jump almost directly to communication so that we have a chance to show that. But we went through a lot of different types of learning. Classical ideas here, classical conditioning, operant conditioning. We talk about latent learning, long-term memory, short-term memory. And as a behavioral ecologist, we think about costs and benefits. So why do you see variation? Why does an animal pay the cost? What benefit do they get for that cost? So why do we have different types of memory? There has to be function and there has to be cost. And if there wasn't both of those things, then we wouldn't expect to see that diversity. So understanding those costs and so on. And then I think our last unit, so any questions about learning you want me to go over in our last couple of messages? As I wait, I'll just cycle through these things. So non-associative learning, associative learning, operant and classical conditioning, latent learning as well. And then, imprinting, another one we went through there. Ways of thing using the standard learning to understand, like, so you're not going to have to remember Steller's J, but I might give you an example of trial and error learning and ask you to match it up. That would be kind of a simple thing to do. So taste aversion learning, interesting case. Larder hoarding, scatter hoarding, those are things that you may not have to remember these specific examples, but those categories, like that's a big area of animal research is understanding hoarding. So understanding larder and scatter hoarding and pilfering, those are definitely things that I would make sure you feel comfortable about. The latent learning ideas, social learning, I think we're rounding to the end of learning. And then we finally got to cognition. We talked a lot about cognition already. So drive theory and so on. Any questions so far as I just go through these in the last couple minutes we have? Okay. So, that's the conceptual model. We don't, it's the thought is there's a virtual energy, but it's not actually energy. But that's the idea of drive theory is that imagine if the animal had this inside their heads and an animal that has a lot of it has got a pressure to express a behavior. but and if it can't express it in the normal way, then it might express it in other ways. Okay. And then communication, which we talked about a lot in the last couple of weeks. So I don't have a clicker for today because you guys are just here for the review. If you have any other questions, feel free to come up. Feel free to send some emails. Otherwise, I am going to, the plan is to release the midterm Monday, and good luck. Yeah. Real quick, there's an announcement from the TAs about, I think, a review. So to see the announcements, there's a review session for communication, module 4, 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. tomorrow. Check the announcements. Yep. You can type it out. You can write it on a tablet and print it. You can draw it out. Yeah, as long as it's produced by you, you can have it. I'm not going to ask you to calculate heritability. I could ask you qualitative questions. Like I might show you one of those graphs that where we said like, and I'd say, yeah, like which one's heritable, which one's not. Yep. I see. I bet that is a temporary thing, but send me a note. And I can put in a ticket or something and see. And try also clearing your cache or with a different browser. It might be that it's giving you that error, but it's really like it thinks you're like there's some flaw and like it thought you already logged in, but like something's been corrupted. But if you like cleared your cache, then it'll come in and like redo the single sign-on. Double-sided.
Have to be doing the tests during the normal class time, so if you get that opinion.
Yeah, I will. I will send it. Okay, yeah, I'll send it. I'm gonna hopefully send, like once it's done, I should be able to print out a paper version, proof it, and then send it over. So they should have it before then. So my goal is to send it to a Monday, so they have time to print it and everything, so that it'll be ready for you. But it's good to know. Thank you for letting me know that it's.
Signed up for the normal class time.
Okay, sounds good. All right.
Thank you. Would it be too late in the semester to start an honors contract?
Nope. Send me. I mean, I end up like they're due with like the last day of finals week, and if you know, I can give input during the semester. I will, but it's not like I check in with you. So if you have an idea for one, like so, there is an honors contract like ideas page. So if you haven't taken a look at that yet, look through that. It's under the course information. Mull over it if you need some help thinking of something. Then, but either way, before you submit something formally, send me a note. And then if I check off on it, then submit it formally and I can run. Yep.
Sorry, just because like if I send you an email about the
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not that it won't be, I mean, I'll, but it's, it, yeah, it's, I'm just worried that like, if I ask a question about drive theory and it only has certain answers, if somebody asks me something where I'm like, well, I could answer this in a way that will exactly answer the question. I don't know if they're coming to me before they saw the exam or after they heard about the exam. I think they're supposed to, because when